You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Lisa See's latest novel, China Dolls, is a sweeping saga about three Asian-American dancers, Grace Lee, Helen Fong, and Ruby Tom, and the lifelong friendship that they forge. The story begins in 1938. The U.S. is in the midst of the Great Depression, the world is on the brink of war, and the nightclub scene is heating up in San Francisco's Chinatown. Grace, Helen, and Ruby meet while auditioning to dance in the floor show at the Forbidden City nightclub, and this story follows their intertwined lives and careers for the next 50 years. Lisa See is the author of several best-selling novels, including Dreams of Joy and Shanghai Girls, and a memoir on Gold Mountain. This new novel is published by Random House. I'm very pleased it has brought her back to our show. You tell the story in the first person through the alternating voices of Grace, Helen, and Ruby. Did you know from the start that you were going to structure it that way?
No, actually, I wrote the first draft of the novel completely from Grace's point of view. But along the way, there were places where Ruby and Helen were kind of screaming out, "Hey, I want to say something here," or "I have a very different take on this." And so when I got to the end and started over at page one, each of those places where one of the other characters was saying, you know, let me out, I want to say something, then I would just completely write that over again from their voices.
They have very different personalities. Mm-hmm. Is it challenging to create distinct voices for each character? It's one thing to do that in dialogue, but it's quite different when you actually have them telling the story.
Right, but each of these young women are so completely different. They have very different backgrounds. Grace grew up as the only, you know, Chinese daughter of the only Chinese family in Plain City, Ohio. Very kind of a Midwestern take on life and the world, and she's never even seen other Chinese before until she gets to San Francisco.
And encouraged to assimilate by
right.
her parents.
Yes, exactly. And then Helen is sort of the exact opposite. Grew up in a very traditional Chinese compound, really like an old Chinese compound, but right in San Francisco. I actually was very lucky to sit next to someone at a dinner about 2 years ago who'd grown up in a compound like that in San Francisco with multiple generations of her family. And so those
When you say compound, we're not talking about just something like Chinatown. We're talking about something more closed.
No, this was in Chinatown, but let's say it was a square block that had four sides and an interior courtyard, much like you would see in China. And so in this instance, the family business is out on the front on the street side, but that the family lives in different wings of this courtyard home.
Replicating what you would have had in China. And then the third one.
The third one is Japanese masquerading as Chinese. And she is unlike any character that I've ever written before. Not only is she Japanese, but she grew up in three different places that had big Japanese American communities. But they also happen to have large naval bases. So, you know, sailors love her and she loves sailors.
You've included several short video profiles in your book's website that feature Asian nightclub stars of the time. Are Grace, Helen, and Ruby based at least in part on those stars, Dorothy Toy, Noel Toy, and Mary Tom?
Yes.
Mary Tom even has the same last name as one of your characters.
Well, it's a pretty common name as Toy, but I would say all of them, as well as a woman named Trudy Long, who lives here in New York City. These were all, you know, some of the earliest performers. Mary Tom, for example, was one of the original eight Forbidden City chorus girls.
There really was a place called the Forbidden
yes,
City.
Yes, it was the most famous of the West Coast clubs. And then in New York, the most famous club was the China Doll.
You have used some of the language I assume dancers at the time must have used. They call themselves ponies. How did you discover the secret language? How much research did you have to
just
do?
Just a ton of research. But, you know, for me, the research is the most fun. So not only did I go out and find these, you know, four women in particular. Dorothy Toy, when I interviewed her, she was 93. She's 97 today. The Chinese Ginger Rogers, you know, had traveled all around the world as the Chinese Ginger Rogers, although she happened to be Japanese. And while I wouldn't say that what happens to Ruby in the novel is based on what happened very specifically to Dorothy, I was able to use some of the elements of what had happened to Dorothy and how she was turned in during the war. And she actually wasn't sent in real life to an internment camp. She spent the war traveling around the South with her sister, who was a singer. And what she told me was they'd never seen a Chinese, they'd never seen a Japanese, they didn't know the difference. We knew we'd be safe.
Now, Forbidden City, you said was really popular. Did it cater mainly to Chinese customers, or did non-Asians also
it
go
was,
to places like
in
that?
In the beginning, it was all Asian customers. And then during the war, it just took off. You know, San Francisco was a liberty port. It was also where all the men shipping out from the Pacific into the Pacific Theater, coming back from the Pacific Theater, passed through there. And what do young men who think they may not have another tomorrow want? Wine, women, and song. And so these clubs that had been going along pretty nicely in San Francisco, Chinatown, really exploded. And so, you know, and I think the more that they were successful, the more then that Chinese who lived in the area were willing to go.
The reason I asked is in New York, the Cotton Club, although it only had African-American performers, catered to white clientele. In fact, if I remember correctly, if you were black, you were either not allowed in or you were put in a special section. Mm-hmm. And that was in light New York. But because these performers were seen as exotic, I would have thought that Chinese performers would have also been seen as exotic and had that kind of appeal.
Very much so. I mean, you're absolutely right, and I think the parallels to the Cotton Club are spot on.
Some of your novel is set at the San Francisco World's Fair, which was preparing to open in 1938. Didn't San Francisco build an island, Treasure Island, to house that fair?
Yes. Yes,
it is was, it still there?
The island is still there, and some of the buildings are still there, although during World War II, most of those buildings were torn down for, a big military installation. It was also where the China Clippers, Pan Am's China Clippers, which were, planes, but they landed in the water. That was to be their big airport. And that building is still there, and you see it sometimes in films like Raiders of the Lost Ark, that sort of thing. I mean, you know, it's very a popular place to film. That 1939 fair was actually San Francisco's second World's Fair. And they took a very different approach than anyone had taken with the World's Fair before, which was they invited countries, only countries that dotted the edge of the Pacific Ocean. And it was the first time that the phrase Pacific Rim was ever used. And now, of course, that's, you know, continues to be so important to us.
My guest is Lisa C. Her latest book, a novel called China Dolls. If I'm not mistaken, all of your novels have been about Chinese protagonists. You're part Chinese, mm-hmm. although I think if people meet you, they would not necessarily know that just by looking at you. But have you ever been tempted to write something that didn't involve Chinese people?
Well, I'm tempted all the time. But
here you have a Japanese character, but that's
right,
not exactly.
But it's not too, it's near,
she's
it's
passing as Chinese.
Mm-hmm. I mean, of course, I've thought about it, but I also want to write things that are the closest to my heart. And I grew up in a very large Chinese American family in Los Angeles. I have about 400 relatives. There are about a dozen that look like me. The majority is still full Chinese in this little spectrum in between.
And then there's some really interesting history in the family. Your great-great-grandfather came here to work on the building of the Transcontinental Railroad. His son, your great-grandfather, became the godfather and patriarch of the Los Angeles Chinatown.
Mm-hmm. Right. So, you know, when I look around me, and, you know, when I was a kid and I looked around me, what I saw were Chinese faces. What I experienced was Chinese culture, Chinese traditions, Chinese customs. And so to me, it's really logical that this is the subject that I write about.
We're very aware of the history of the internment of the Japanese during World War II. But your book makes it quite clear that there was a lot of prejudice against Chinese Americans as well.
Mm-hmm.
were people conflating them with the Japanese?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, and again, particularly in the West. And so they had the Chinese Consolidated Benevolent Association and other fraternal organizations that gave Chinese armbands to wear, placards to put in their stores, in their restaurants, in their home windows.
Saying, I'm not Japanese?
Yes, exactly. And, you know, my family still has some of those things, and it's just amazing. But, you know, people didn't know the difference. They couldn't tell the difference.
And the laws prohibited intermarriage, didn't they?
That's right. In 28 states had
including California, you could not, a Chinese person could not marry a Caucasian?
Yes, down to a quarter Chinese, not until 1948. And then there were some states, like Washington State, that the law didn't change till 1965.
In your book, what draws Grace, Helen, and Ruby to each other when they first meet? Because they are very different.
They're very different, and I think hard times, for one thing. You know, that they're all kind of orphaned in a way. Even Helen, who lives in this big family, you know, there's only one reason that they would have let her dance in a nightclub. You know, a traditional conservative family would have let her dance in a nightclub. And that's if she'd done something really wrong.
They considered her a fallen woman.
Yes, exactly. Or something really terrible had happened to her. So these are all young women really on their own. They each have different degrees of ambition and different degrees of talent. But I think at first they just feel if we can band together, we're going to be stronger.
And these characters keep a lot of secrets from each other despite their friendships, reveal them slowly over the years. One of the first major secrets is that Ruby isn't Chinese, that she is Japanese. Several reviewers have described your book as a historical novel, and it does contain a great deal of detail that I assume you discovered while you were doing all of that research. But do you think of this as a historical novel?
I do. I mean, I think all of my novels really are historical novels. Yes, that there's a always, I mean, I always start first with the relationship and what I want the deep emotion of the story to be, but then to set that within a historic period or within a historic context, it really gives me a way to sort of explore, in particular, Chinese-American history that's been lost, forgotten, deliberately covered up.
In her June 2nd review in the Washington Post, Eugenia Zuckerman called the book an emotional, informative, and brilliant page-turner that resonates with resilience and humanity. Do you think when you're writing books that I'm writing a page-turner?
I hope so.
Well, there are books that aren't intended to be page-turners.
Right, but you know, I think
we were talking about
have
Ulysses before.
Oh,
that's
I heard
the opposite.
That's exactly right.
That is not a page-turner.
No, but I think if you can really reach into people's hearts and into their emotions, you know, that emotional depth, I think, is what keeps people turning the pages. You want to know, is everything going to work out for these poor people? But also, I chose the 10 years that I did because, as you said in your introduction, you've got the end of the Depression, the World War II, and actually the introduction of television in a big way into our homes. And so within this 10 years, doesn't have zeros on the end, but within that one decade, you see that we as Americans start to look at each other differently. We start to look at the outside world differently. We change how we dress, what we eat, you know, how we spend time with our families, what we do for entertainment. And so all of that changes in just these 10 years, and it is a historical moment. And for all of us right now today, you know, history is affecting us. We may not know exactly how, you know, we might need to have some perspective on it, but it does have an effect on us. And maybe one of those page-turning aspects is that I couldn't write the characters to the history. I was really trying to be true to life. You don't know, you know, on December 1st that December 7th is around the corner. And when that happens, your life changes immediately.
Did American attitudes toward the Chinese change during those 10 years?
Yes, absolutely.
Did people start going to Chinese restaurants in a way that they didn't before?
Well, for one thing, 1943, suddenly U.S. and China were allies. Mm-hmm. And so the Chinese Exclusion Act that had barred the immigration of all Chinese immigrants had made it so that you couldn't become a naturalized citizen. That was finally overturned. And so for the first time, Chinese could now become naturalized citizens. I think there was a much greater openness about going to Chinese restaurants, to going to curio shops, all of that kind of thing. The other is that all of the negatives that had been out there about the Chinese for decades now suddenly shifted to the Japanese. And so one of the things I found that I just thought was just unbelievable, you'd never see it today, were two articles just 2 weeks after Pearl Harbor, one in Time, one in Life, that had a diagram of a man with arrows pointing at different parts of his body trying to explain for their readers to help them with this delicate question of how to tell the difference between a Chinese and a Japanese. And then went on, you know, with those arrows to show what they thought the differences were, which, of course, you know, again, today you could never have anything like that in a mainstream magazine.
I wonder if they did something similar during the Korean War.
Maybe.
The last time you were here, you said that your mother, Carolyn C., the writer and literary critic, often reads your early drafts and gives you advice. Did you show her this book before?
Oh, absolutely. Yes, there are five people who read my manuscript right all at the exact same time. And, the reason I have five people is that they all look at it differently and they all have different questions. And that's why we edit, to try to make the story better.
Lisa C.'s latest book, now edited and made all better, is called China Dolls. And it is published by Random House. Thank you so much for being on our show again.
Thanks for having me.